Go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
When Susan Gallimore, a mother from the San Francisco Bay Area, appeared on the American MSNBC network in 2004, she was surprised to be paired in debate with a well-known media pundit on the Iraq War, retired General Barry McCaffrey. All she'd done, after all, was pay a visit to her son at his place of work, Camp Anaconda, in the then deadly Sunni Triangle of Iraq. For her pains, General McCaffrey accused her of a politically motivated act that endangered our troops, meaning American troops. Susan wasn't deterred and went on to speak to the mothers of other young men engaged in war zones from Iraq to Israel's West Bank. The resulting book is called Long Time Passing. It's a different perspective on the war. But why, oh why, did she do it?
Well, at the time, I was really under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress. You know, my son here was in Iraq, and he had spent 9 months in Afghanistan, and I'd kind of gone through that sort of nail biting. But when he was sent to Iraq, which was clearly a strategic blunder, as we call it, or foreign policy horror, I didn't want my son there without me having told him. That, you know, terrible things can happen to people in war, including people doing acts that they would be ashamed of in their lives later. And I needed to tell him that.
I mean, so, you said that you were worried for his human spirit, weren't you?
I was worried for his human spirit, exactly. And, you know, you as a British person, and I come from British background, our families were in the Second World War, and my family was in some of my family members were in the Anglo-Boer War on each side. I had a grandfather fighting for the British, and I had a grandmother who was a civilian. And my brothers were in the South African Defense Force, and I saw, and I had also seen a lot of, you know, people from the Holocaust and so forth, and I saw what war did. And I wanted my son to know that these things can happen and you have to do everything you can to avoid being embroiled in that kind of activity.
You went across to Iraq at the time, just before Anbar and just before the absolute bloody worst of it, frankly. Although we didn't know that at the time. You were in a delegation of 11 others, most of them women. Just tell me about it. I mean, what were you doing?
Well, I hooked up with this delegation. It was a Code Pink delegation, and they were the only people going there. And
Code Pink, by the way, it's an American pressure group. I mean, we've seen them at the conventions. They were very, very visible in the conventions of 2004, particularly, especially at the Republican convention. And they were very successful in getting a lot of media attention for their work.
Right, and they were still kind of getting up and running at the time I went with them. They were just becoming well-known. And again, they were the only group going over there, and so I was the last person to join that delegation, and off we went. And a lot of people were doing different things. There were some women there for art, and other women there to do theater, and other women there just to, you know, be on this kind of a trip. I was the only military mom at the time, and so the idea was that we would meet with other Iraqis, and that was something that I really wanted to do. I wanted to find out from Iraqi women, particularly Iraqi mothers, how things were going for their families. And so every day we would do something different, and the first day we met with a woman who'd pretty much had her whole family killed by American troops in the street. We also went to a hospital where we visited a pediatric oncology ward. And so it was very traumatizing to see this. And I really felt like we needed to know these stories in the United States, where at the time everything was looking like it was just going hunky-dory, you know.
Well, of course it had come out of the initial phase, which seemed to have gone so very well for,
exactly.
for the troops.
Yeah.
How did the other women treat you as the only military mom? I mean, did they discuss your attitudes to your son and you know,
no,
why you let him
go
and all that stuff?
Well, there was a little bit of that. Not as much as you might expect, you know. Everyone was, as I say, kind of there for their own reason, and they were concentrating on that to some degree. So there wasn't a lot of discussion, really, about what I was doing. When I tracked down my son at the base. A few people wanted to come with just to see. And I said, you know, this is really a private meeting between me and my son. And I really don't think it's appropriate for me to take a visitor. I want to spend this time with my child. Well, he wasn't a child. He was a man. I wanted to spend that time in a private way with my child.
Yeah. And I mean, that was an amazing thing, because if you're in the military, and particularly if you're serving in a front line, the rules don't let you communicate where you are. They're very specific about that. Even to your own mother, you can't say, this is where I am. How on earth did you find him?
Well, that's true. And if you do want to get onto a base, you have to go through the public affairs officer. And I was staying in this hotel in Baghdad where there were other journalists staying, and one of them was very helpful to me. He said that he'd been doing research in the area, and he knew about Camp Anaconda, and he knew who the PAO, the public affairs officer, was, and he really helped me a lot. And I did get an email from my son at some point saying, you know, well, first he'd said, don't come. But then once he knew I was in Iraq, he said, well, they're probably not going to let you on the base, but this is where I am. And he had permission to tell me that, because I had already emailed the public affairs officer.
Yeah. Well, amazing. How did you get to it? How far was it from Baghdad?
It's not that far. It's about, I think, less than 40 miles. But, of course, you're going from an urban area into a rural area, and different rules apply. And so I had to wear a hijab. And the night before I was to leave, the person that had agreed to drive me changed his mind. And so I had to quickly scramble and find someone else. And I was able to do that. This young man, Ahmed, was about 23, agreed to drive me. And, you know, it was a business agreement. I paid him, and off we went. And he actually didn't know the way. He was a Shia, and he didn't know this area, which was predominantly Sunni. And so I only got wind of that when he started stopping the car and asking people for directions, you know. And so, and then at that point, I asked him to, you know, fill me in a little more. I mean, I was really in the state of panic. I had to see my kids, so I wasn't really paying much attention to Ahmed. And it turned out that he had just married. His wife was expecting their first baby. She was like 2 months pregnant. They'd been married maybe 6 months. And I was shocked that he had done this. And I asked him, why would you take me here under these circumstances? And he said, well, you know, it's because you're a mother and what you're doing is really touching me. And I thought that was very gracious of him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not only gracious.
If he was a Sunni in a Shiite area, he must have been terrified, because bandits.
He was a Shia in a Sunni area.
Shia in a Sunni area. Yeah.
Yeah. At that point, the breakdown wasn't as great between the two groups. It became much, much more intense later.
I mean, it is amazing. And you appeared at the camp, and you appear with a hijab covering your head. The soldiers yell at you. You walk out of the car. They say, get back in the car, ma'am. You tear the hijab off your head, and you say, I'm an American. And their attitude changes radically.
Exactly.
Tell us more.
Yeah.
I mean, what did they say?
I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I think it's just a function of being in a strange place and working from stereotypes. We know that there was a lot of I suppose it's really racism against the Iraqis. You know, a lot of hostility, because they didn't understand, the troops didn't understand the language, they didn't understand the culture, they didn't understand anything about really what they were doing there. They were getting mixed messages, I think, all the time. And so for them to see someone like them or from their country, I think, was kind of a surprise. I also have the feeling that, again, the public affairs officer had mentioned that I might show up. She never responded to me in my email, but I think that there was a feeling that, you know, this could happen. Because when I said I have permission to be here and I need to talk with your, the sergeant or whoever, they seemed to understand that I had had a plan.
I was thinking tangentially of the movie Midnight Express, in which the man's girlfriend goes to see him in a Turkish prison and finds him in a strange, half-crazed state. Were you anxious that you might find your son in some way just altered?
I was, yeah, I was. And, I mean, he'd spent 6 months, 9 months, actually. It was supposed to be 6 months. It was 9 months in Afghanistan, and that was in real combat. And he did come back, I would say, with some symptoms that I would consider to be symptoms of culture shock or trauma or, you know. And I was very reluctant to approach him about that. It was very painful for me to think of my child being affected that way. But when he was in Iraq the first time, he was not one of the combat troops. So although he was very highly trained, he was not in a combat unit at that point. The second time when he went, he was in a combat unit. The second time he was a special forces medic, very high, highly responsible position. But there was a lot of combat in that second tour of duty in Iraq. But the first tour, there was less of that for him personally.
Did he ever say to you if he received any comeback from the unit after your visit, because you came there to visit him?
Well, we haven't really talked about that very much, but I'm assuming that he did. And I think that was something that I did not recognize, that there would be a lot of blowback for him. So I subsequently became a lot more aware of that when I became a GI rights counselor, and I realized I began to understand some of how the military, you know, treats people that are a little bit out of the ordinary or have, you know, some kind of difference. So at the time, I did not know it, and he hasn't really talked to me about it, but yeah. I'm pretty sure a lot of it went on.
Your son's story ends at that point in the book, doesn't it? Because, as you say, he went out for a second tour as a medic for the Special Forces. Now he's at university, at least as we leave him in the book. Is that still the case?
That's still the case, yeah. And I just learned that he's going to be getting married soon, so that's very good news. And, you know, I really recognize how lucky I am compared to almost 5,000 other mothers in this country that my son is, you know, doing okay, relatively okay. And, of course, there are tens of thousands of mothers whose children are really suffering a lot of psychological trauma.
Much of the book now is really dedicated to telling the stories of people who have been through the toils of war and who have not come out very well at all.
Right.
Why did you do it? Was it a sense of obligation? Did you feel that you couldn't stop having gone off on this great journey?
Well, I really realized that there's so little emphasis here on the families and the ordinary people in the communities that it kind of explains to me why there's so little understanding of war in general. In this country, we've except for the Civil War, we're a country that has been blessed with not very much combat at all. I mean, we have our violence and so forth here, but it's not your home isn't being bombed, your home isn't being bulldozed, you know. And I think that people here tend to think that the folks in the Middle East are so different to them, and they just want to be like us, and they just want to live like us, and it's just not true. The people there love their own lands, and they love their own cultures, and they love their own communities, and we don't understand that. And it became clear to me that my role here could be to share the stories of people who feel as strongly as we do about our families and our cultures and our countries and you know, our art and our history. And I really wanted to find a way to make these people come alive in a way that our media doesn't really, you know, allow them to.
Particularly through the pediatrician that you talked about a little bit at the Baghdad Hospital, you tell the story of this people who were systematically bombed back in time from the early 1990s, you know, who lost a comfortable middle-class standard of living, who lost access to modern medicine, who lost access to all sorts of things that a civilization in our time needs, and indeed that they had achieved. This woman was very... It's a very powerful and impassioned cry that she made to you in 2004, essentially against the coalition provisional authority and everything associated with it.
Yeah. Yeah, and while we were hearing what, you know, we were soon to hear that the mission was accomplished, but in fact, the mission has never been accomplished, and Iraq has gone on to have cholera. It's gone on to have the highest rate of child mortality in any country that's ever been developed. The sliding back has been the greatest in any country, and we're responsible for that as Americans.
You talk about something called Blackwater fever, which was just unknown in Iraq before the before the war.
Exactly. Yeah, and again, these are the kinds of facts that are not really getting out much here. And, you know, I want to just share, I had read an article about some geographers that had done a study, and what they did was they watched, at night they would watch the lighting, how Baghdad lit up. And slowly, the less and less of Baghdad was being lit up. And at first, they thought it was because there was a lack of electricity. But in fact, that had been factored into their research. And they later realized that these neighborhoods were going dark because of the attacks, the Sunni against the Shia against the Sunni. And, you know, in fact, it was a form of ethnic cleansing that was going on. And this is why the Baghdad was going dark. And that was a little article hidden in one of our newspapers here, but I thought that was a really important point to bring home. You know, the danger is not ended in Iraq.
Although, curiously enough, we were discussing this very point with our correspondent in Baghdad last night, and he was saying that by contrast to his first visit there 4 years ago, there is a lot more light about the place now. It's very much...
I guess we'll be able to tell when the Iraqis are able to return home. You know, when they feel safe enough to return home, the refugees outside of the country.
You went then to the West Bank and to Jerusalem, and you talked to a lot of Palestinians. I wondered if I could just read you a little bit, because it seems to me it's typical of the kind of women that you were meeting across the lines, if you like, people who you wouldn't normally expect to meet, but you have to go out of your way to meet them, as you did. There's a lady called Nurit El-Hanan, and she says, once this so-called war on terror is over, there'll be another one, because the politicians will need more money or more oil or more funds from drug trafficking. Mothers are beyond such games. Most don't serve in armies or participate in high-level politics, so they have to have a clearer view of life and what's important. Mothers are able to dialogue and carry on dialogues with many children. They deal with real things and real people, and they're capable of judging cleanly. This is more than most men can do, especially here in Israel, where men are so oriented towards the army, what it is, and what it does. But most Israeli mothers cannot think cleanly about Israel's situation because they are in it. Education here is so heavily biased toward the military that most mothers can't say to themselves, my husband is a murderer, my son is a murderer, and I have to do something about that. You're trying to let these women speak in their own voice. I just wonder how often their feelings mirrored your own feelings.
Well, Nurit actually is very close to my heart, because her sons were not happy with her when she decided that she was not going to allow them to go into Lebanon. And they went through a period where they were very heavily picked on by the IDF forces. And so she had been through some of the same thing that I had with my child. And I agreed with her, you know, that it is very difficult for mothers particularly to stand up and say, we're not going to do this anymore. It's very difficult for anybody to take that kind of a stand. I think it's harder for a woman who is perhaps in a marriage to a man who's more mainstream than she is. In my case, I was a single parent, so I didn't have someone at home telling me I oughtn't to do that. So, but there are, of course, women who would have an instinct that I have had to go and find out what's happening with my kid, and would be dissuaded by their husbands. And I think that's something that Nurit allowed me to understand. Yeah. You know, that we one of the things that we really need to learn as women is to be to act out on our inner desires for our families.
Now, I'm not sure if I read you right, but at one point in the book, when you're going into the occupied territories in Israel, in Palestine, You seem to draw a parallel between the motivation of the suicide bomber in Palestine and the motivation of the young American who's in Afghanistan. Is that right? Or is it just that you raise that question and say, well, let's think about these two people?
I was really trying to suggest that one way to think about why a suicide bomber becomes a suicide bomber is to, and I think I used the word a wounded narcissism, a psychological term, is when you're so crushed or when you believe that you've got, I compared it with the United States bombing Afghanistan because we felt like, you know, these Afghans, or they weren't Afghans, these people didn't have the right to bomb us because we're America, we're exceptional, we're, you know, all of these great things. How dare they? And so we're going to respond by bombing them.
You say here our national response to the September 11 attacks were to bomb Afghanistan, a country even then suffering from decades of war and unable to deny safe haven to al-Qaeda operatives. American pride and narcissism was wounded by the effrontery of the attacks. In the name of the United States and its citizens, the Bush administration extracted knee-jerk revenge, an eye for an eye, clothed in the language of righteousness. So you distinguish between the policies of the administration and the instincts of the people.
Yeah, and I think the parallel I was trying to make was when we look at let's say a Palestinian suicide bomber, let's think of them reacting in a way that we reacted to after 9/11. We were devastated by that, and the Palestinian suicide bomber is devastated because they have so few options. This is one of the few ways that they feel, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm just saying this is one of the few ways that they feel they can retaliate against a Goliath, and they're the David. So I try to create a parallel and an analogy so that people could begin to understand the mindset a little bit.
You did actually meet a Lebanese woman, didn't you, who was fiercely proud of her son, who she knew was training to be a suicide bomber.
Well, the woman that I think you're talking about, Zuhre, her son had become a martyr, and he wasn't a suicide bomber, but he was fighting against the Israelis. And he was killed in the Lebanese attack on Lebanon in 2006. And she was very proud of him, and her whole family was very proud of him. And she said, "We know we can hold up our head because this family member, is a martyr." And her younger son was looking forward to the day when his mother would hold up a photograph of him and say that he was a martyr. You know, now it's not an uncommon worldview. And it's also this is a peasant family, more or less, you know. So this isn't the most educated class of people, but this is a common or not uncommon point of view. You know, we're proud of our kids for being martyrs because they're fighting for us and our land.
At the end of the book, you talk about your work with returned GIs, and a lot of that is dealing with people who have been severely traumatized. Just in terms of one policy, the stop-loss policy, it's supposed to end this year. We've heard quite recently that it's supposed to end and that people won't have their terms extended. I mean, you were very aware of the trauma and the turmoil that stop loss has caused in people's lives.
Yeah. And of course, if you're one of those people that's being stop loss today and you know that stop loss is going to end next year, there is going to be a lot of anger attached to why you have to go for, say, the fourth or fifth tour of duty into a war zone, especially a war zone in an urban area. So, you know, let's end stop loss now.
One story, don't you, of a unit which were about to get on their helicopter. Was it in Afghanistan?
And
the word came that they had to stay for another 4 months, and they started beating each other up.
A military mother shared that story with me. I mean, how heartbreaking is that? Everybody's looking forward to leaving because it's been so awful there. and you're about, everything is packed, and you're about to get on the helicopter that's going to take you back home where your family is waiting for you, and you're told as you're about to step onto this vehicle, this aircraft, that you're going to have to stay. So, yes, the troops turned on one another, and the morale was very low.
We've talked several times to Cindy Sheehan, another military mom who lost her son in combat, and she took her protest, as we remember, to the president's ranch. You at one time took your protest to a military base in Texas, and you were trying to tell people about something called the GI Right Hotline. What is that, and why do you think GIs are in the dark?
Well, the GI Rights Hotline is a free service to any military member or military family, and it's not at all affiliated with the government or with the military. And what we give GIs is information into whatever issue they're concerned with. In some cases, they have been enlisted fraudulently, and they don't want to go, and they don't know what to do, and they've got a recruiter telling them that they can't do anything, that they've got to go no matter what. Or someone who wants to be a conscientious objector, or someone who's having psychological problems and his commander is telling him that he's just got to suck it up. You know, there are lots of ways to approach the military, and our job on the GI Rights Hotline was to understand those ways and to help the troops figure out what they wanted to do, you know, give them some information that would help them decide. We do not advise them. We just give them the information or tell them how they can get that information. And we also tell them what has happened to people in a situation that's similar to theirs. Here's some of what can happen. Now, it doesn't always happen that way, because it really depends on who your commander is. And some commanders are very harsh, and some commanders are very fair. So that's what the GRI hotline does. And I was down there to share the number with these folks, because a lot of people stopped and talked to me, and they were going back for three or four tours of duty, and some of them were broken. They just couldn't do it anymore. And in that case, there is information that they can have that might help them decide, you know, if they want to do that or not. A lot of them just do it because they are broken, and they think that there's no way out. And so the GI Rights Hotline tries to help them sort through what some of their options are.
Susan Gallimore's book is called Long Time Passing.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads, and BBC iPlayer.
This is Five Live.